Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, welcome to Hollywood Crime Scene. This is Rachel Fisher.
Hi, this is Desi Jettikin. Hey. Rachel.
Wow.
Here we are.
I know.
So since we've been having a lot of fun recapping old reality TV shows on our Patreon, this is a plug.
Wow.
To go subscribe to our Patreon. We have a lot of fun stuff going on right now. We've been getting great response to some new things we've started putting up there.
Many people are saying,
we love it. More girls. You're killing it.
The reviews are in.
So I thought I would take a deep dive into an infamous reality TV show from the early 2000s. Only you won't remember this show because it was never actually made.
Oh my God.
A fact that left wannabe contestants baffled and broken, wondering if they had been conned.
Broken?
They were broken. Their dreams were shattered. So the more details that emerged, though, made it seem less likely that they were conned. And it was more of a Firefest Willy Wonka experience type situation.
Wow.
It all started with an advert. This was set in the UK, okay, by the way.
I was going to say.
Because there's definitely some words in these papers. I was like, oh, that's what they mean by that. I'll get to those later. In 2002, looking for contestants for a new British reality TV show that was soon to be launched. The prize was £100,000. The concept, it was unclear. The wannabe contestants were people who thought of themselves as what was described in the advert, characterful, resourceful, and energetic. All they had to do was give up a year of their life to participate in this secret show with an unknown concept. Needless to say, thousands applied to have their shot at this 15 minutes of fame. Now, sources for this episode are a documentary called The Greatest Show Never Made, as well as a ton of reporting from The Guardian and The Daily Mail. In particular, The Guardian's Rupert Smith, who wrote extensively about the story, Daniel Ray Wright, and Lucy Manigan, also from The Guardian. Hold on a second. I'm scrolling down. So let's get into it.
Okay.
All that for just that one little sentence. So let's talk a little bit about the reality TV landscape in the early 2000s. So people might not remember, but this was really when reality TV kind of took off, like what we think of reality TV as. And in general, there was also this kind of new millennium vibe happening where people were kind of like, anything is possible right now. Like, do you remember that?
Of course. I remember it was like reality TV was the future and you couldn't. It's like it happened. No pun intended. It felt like clockwork. As soon as the clock struck 2000, it was like, here's Survivor. Here's The Weakest Link. Here's Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And then it was like, and then the next year, like, here's The Bachelor, here's The Swan, here's Joe Wants to Marry Joe Millionaire.
Right. And it kind of hit with this time where the internet was starting and it was like, anyone can be famous now. Yeah. We all have this opportunity to kind of strike it rich or whatever. So as you mentioned, there were hit shows like Survivor was like a huge one. And also Big Brother that was particularly huge in the UK. So by 2002, Big Brother was on its third season in the UK. It had an audience of almost 6 million people per week. And it was a really popular show at the time. If you don't know Big Brother, it basically is a group of people going to live in this house, cut off from the outside world, and they have cameras on them 24/7, and you're basically watching their day-to-day life. There is a competition element to it. Did you ever watch Big Brother?
No, I'm sorry. Did you say that this show originated in the UK?
Yeah. That guy is from the UK who created it.
Wow.
And it almost started at the in the US around the same time, but it was like huge.
Yeah, and then you get like eliminated, like one person from the house, they vote you out.
Right, there's alliances kind of form, so you start seeing that kind of element as well. So yeah, I mean, it was definitely like a water cooler type show, especially in the UK, I think even more than the US, even though it was popular here.
Can I just offer a correction before anyone comes for me?
Sure.
I realize that The Weakest Link and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire are technically game shows, but I feel like they fit into like what was happening at the era because they were like must-see shows. Like,
well, and they were really just casting characters too.
Yes.
I see where the connection is.
I don't know.
It was a different type of game show.
Maybe it was just me that felt like that just lumped all of those in together because like Survivor and then those two game shows kind of came out at the same time.
I also think those were imports in the US. I think those were UK shows originally as well. Especially The Weakest Link, I think.
Remember
was.
That lady?
Yeah, she was like an icon.
Celebrity overnight.
She was.
That red haired.
She
broad.
Was. And we talked about the UK version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire because there were some scandals, I think. Didn't we?
We did a whole show, I think, about game show scandals.
Right.
Or reality show scandals.
I think it was game show because I did search for this to make sure we didn't cover it. Because you know how you're kind of like, did we? I don't know. Like, I forget things. So anyways, like I said, Big Brother also had like a prize money at the end. There were other shows in the UK that were really popular. The Mole, which also came over to the US at some point.
Yeah.
That was a good show. I liked that one.
I never watched it.
And one called Jailbreak was big in the UK. And that's where a group of people would work together to break out of prison.
Like, so it's like an escape room?
Yeah, kind of. And like it was like people wanted to watch people work together to solve these problems. So adding to this vibe that was happening at this time, these contestants would become celebrities. And they were often able to parlay this reality show stint into successful media careers. So we're talking about just regular average Joes becoming really famous for no particular talent and being able to achieve things that were usually reserved for actors, musicians, etc., like this fame and wealth. So this was very appealing to a lot of people who saw this as a chance to become famous without any like stress of having to have a talent. So as I mentioned, this is also the turn of the new millennium, and that also is giving people this feeling of anything could happen, like the ultimate New Year's resolution vibe. Like we're like, we could do it all. Like, I don't know what it was. It was like the future. It was crazy.
It really did feel like the future.
And here we are 24 years later, just like,
what happened?
It's fine.
What happened to our sparkly silver dreams?
Where's our hopes and dreams? So people were really excited by the possibilities, and you know, nothing offered regular people more opportunity for adventure than reality TV. No one was more excited by the possibilities of reality TV fame and success more than a young man who went by the name Nikita Rushin. He wanted to make the greatest show ever made. Now, I'm sorry. In the early 2002, this guy who went by Nick Rushin placed an advertisement for a year-long television program in publications like The Stage and The Evening Standard, which invited characterful, resourceful, and energetic people to apply for the chance to raise their profile and potentially win £100,000. In the documentary, we meet some of these contestants, including Rosie, Lucy, Jane, John, Tim, and Daniel. And most of them spoke about how this ad and this idea of reality TV really like found them in a place in their lives where it was like super appealing. Most of them were bored by their 9-to-5 job. They had no real excitement in their personal lives. This is them saying this, not me. And this fantasy of what this adventure could lead to was really enticing. Some of them were very young and they were like, hey, this is like a gap year. Like, why not do it now when I have the time before I have a family and career? And others were actually struggling actors or performers, writers. And they were like, hey, this could be a perfect opportunity for me to jumpstart my career because it's not taking off based on what I'm doing now. Lucy also had an interest and becoming a TV presenter. So that was what appealed to her about this. That's like a real legit career in the UK.
Oh, yeah.
TV presenter.
I feel like whenever there's like a crossover, like someone famous person from the UK makes it over to America, it's like, what were they? Oh, they were a famous presenter.
Yeah. It like, just doesn't seem like a job title we use here, even though I know we have that.
Like James Corden.
Or like Nick Lachey is a TV presenter,
well,
right?
Now he is. But he
yeah, but like,
but he didn't start out that way.
No, but that's like what that job is.
You know who I think our most famous TV presenter is Mario Lopez.
Yes. Because I feel like even James Corden, that's like a talk show host.
Mario Lopez will present a pizzeria opening. Like,
yes.
He will present anything.
It's like, we need someone to say something.
Get Mario.
He'll go to the Grove.
That guy, if you ever want to see a celebrity and you've never seen a celebrity before, just go to the Grove on any given day and Mario Lopez will be there presenting something.
Oh, yeah. I've seen him there.
I have too.
It's wild. You're like, oh, shit. He actually is always here. So most of these people are also fans of Big Brother. So they've already seen what could happen to these people, because literally everyone is watching Big Brother at this time in the UK. It's like you have to in order to kind of fit into society. Like,
yeah,
you need to, like, you know how it feels now. There's a show where if you're not watching it, you feel like you're out of the loop with everybody.
Totally. I would be interested in a master list of every single average Joe who got their start on reality TV, not anyone who had a career, like an entertainment yeah. career prior, who was able to successfully launch into a media career.
Right.
With longevity.
Yeah. That would be interesting.
Like, they weren't just famous from doing reality
especially
shows.
Where it's not like a Bravo show, like a real, like, this is a bunch of regular people. Do you
yeah.
know what I mean? Like, so I also wanted to stress that at this point, we hadn't really hit that backlash that comes a bit later where people are sort of thinking of reality TV as a very low art form and trash TV. It was still kind of new and it hadn't kind of gotten there yet.
Oh, I was already a hater.
You were in the early 2000s?
Absolutely. I was like a hater of reality TV. And
really?
Until like I started, and like I was really into the competition shows, but like the like singing ones. So obviously I watched American Idol and I loved Project Runway when that came out. And then America's Next Top Model. But in the early days, I was such a hater.
So you hated Survivor?
Yeah, and I never even watched one episode. I just thought I was like in eighth grade and I was like, ugh, Survivor.
Well, you were an early hater, but it just hadn't reached that point where it was like so many trash shows were up and people were like started writing think piece type things where it was like, why are we, you know, what's happened to scripted television? It's like still wasn't being replaced by reality TV yet.
Yeah. It was like, it said something about society and
yes.
society was crumbling.
And I think that happened more when we got those dime a dozen, low budget Joe Millionaire, Who Wants to Marry a Millionaire, like that kind of stuff that was just being kind of produced nonstop at a certain point. So many of the contestants came across these adverts in like the UK version of Backstage called The Stage. They were also just being passed out on flyers around London. And the line about seeking contestants in particularly that resonated with some of these guys was that they were looking for people with plenty of style and a taste for the bizarre, which was more important than experience. So a lot of people were like, that's me. I got no experience, but I'm great. You
yeah.
know, it's just sort of hitting them in that moment where in that spot where it's kind of like, that's me. The mystery surrounding the project kind of gave it more appeal for the contestants. And they were like filling in all the blanks. Like, this was truly a lifetime opportunity for them. Opportunity of a lifetime, sorry. They began to email the production company. They were instructed to send in fun little blurbs about themselves. So they were doing all these things to kind of stand out in the producer's eyes. And, you know, these guys are like, we talked to some of the guys in the some of the people, the contestants in the documentary, and they're literally like already doing things like spending the money.
What?
Like kind of not spending it, but they're like, I'm going to pay off my student loans.
Oh,
I'm going to do this. They're fantasizing about, like, they're already making these plans for what they're going to do with this $100,000 or 100,000 pounds.
And they, that they have yet to win.
No.
That they don't even know what they're going to be asked to do.
No. So thousands email production, and production narrows it down to like hundreds of people who are going to get this chance to audition, attend these auditions, and have a chance to impress producers. So along with the email telling them that they would be moving forward in the casting, they received a map with an X marking the location for the audition for NRP Nikita Russian Productions. Many thought the name was bizarre, but swept it aside thinking, that's showbiz. Besides the map with the X, that really made them feel like this game had already begun. Yeah. Like they were on this little adventure. So their imaginations were really running wild. The location spot was on Ravens Island, which is a private island in the middle of the Thames River. I didn't even know there were islands there, but there's like 50.
You're kidding
me. I'm not kidding. I looked it up on Wikipedia and the list was like really long.
How big is this river?
I think it's a big river, but these are small islands, obviously.
What the fuck?
I know. I was like, that's why I had to look it up. I was like, a private island in the middle of the Thames? Like, what? So it was a really fancy cricket pavilion. It's kind of like those islands in the Bay Area. Okay. It's like that little small where they have like one building on it.
It's like Angel Island.
Yeah. So once they get to the location, they were taken on a boat to go to the venue. And everything was like really like cool. Like, woo, this is a big deal. One of the girls who had been to a Big Brother audition, she was like telling everyone, this is really similar to what we had to do on Big Brother. So everyone's like, ooh, like,
it's
wow.
It's fancy. It's yeah. official.
So this is also where potential contestants got their first glimpse of Nick Russian. Now he is 6'6", really handsome. He has shoulder length, foppish hair, and people describe his style as Byronian.
Wait, what's Byronian?
It kind of means like he's wearing a velvet jacket and like a ruffled shirt. Wait. Like that kind of poet look. Do you know what I'm talking about? That's like every article described him this way.
Okay.
So
now is he Nick Russian like the country or Nick Russian like Patrice Russian?
No, it's like spelled like Russian, like the country.
And he's Byronian?
Nikita Russian. He's English. He's not Russian, too.
But what's... okay.
Byronian is like a style like the poet.
So he looks like Shakespeare.
He has like a foppish kind of like velvet jacket.
Yeah.
He's really good looking.
Okay.
I mean, he's got a... he like looks good. So he's kind of floating in and out of the area. People describe him as someone you kind of see, and then seconds later, he's gone. They also meet this entire production team of NRP, a cameraman, a director, there's PAs, and there's even a psychoanalyst there, which is a common reality TV show thing. These contestants often get psych assessments, making sure they can, you know, handle the demands of what's coming, but also to protect contestants from a potential harmful person. Now, some people manage to get through.
We've
seen it happen. Like, did Chelsea take a psych assessment?
Just watch Love is Blind.
So whatever, that, you know, that's a thing. People are then separated into small groups and begin doing like trust building exercises, like trust falls. And then they get their first major challenge. They're told that they would go back to the mainland and as a group with no money, basically wander around the city getting ingredients to make a cake, as well as finding someone who would let them come in their home and bake the cake.
Now, this is 100 people right now, or have they?
But they're broken up into smaller groups.
Okay.
So like they're 10.
But they're asking like all of these people.
Yeah. So these groups of 10 are broken into these smaller groups. Each group goes around London asking for, knocking on people's doors. And there's footage of this you can watch. Literally like, can we have some, we're on a reality show. Like,
can you give me a cup of sugar?
And people are like, here's some sugar and I have one egg. And then one older lady, like this cute little English grandma, she's like, here you go. Like, come on, you can come in and bake it. Like,
yeah.
So then they put together these cakes and like some of them look like shit. Like it'll just be a chocolate cake and they put like silver dragees on it or whatever, like just on top of it.
Yeah.
Trying to make it like whatever. So, and people are like into it. And I have to say, it looked like a fun challenge in a way.
This is still the audition process.
Yes, this is still the audition process. They're like living. They rush back to the island to beat the time limit they had. And then they basically like watch Nick and the crew eat their cake and like make their little decisions about things. So they're like pumped after this experience. They had the thrill of completing this task successfully. And many of them started feeling like they were seeing this deeper concept emerge, winning strangers over, asking for help from strangers and receiving it, creating this beautiful sense of community. Like they were seeing what his vision was. So excitement was really building over this reality show that might be a more powerful, have a more powerful impact than just entertainment. So everyone left that day on a high and anxiously awaited the email that they were going to be one of the 30 to be selected to star in Nick Rushen's program, currently known as Project MS2.
MS2.
That sounds like MK Ultra.
Yeah.
Stuff to me. So, eventually the winning candidates are informed that they're going to be on the show. They are sent a contract they're supposed to sign in return. And they're told that the project will last for a year, so that most of them had to give up their flats and jobs. The contract stated that their food and accommodation and like minor spending money would be provided for. And they were all to meet in London on June 10th, 2002 for the program to begin filming. It was called the launch date. Each contestant was also told to set up a bank account to which Rushen could have access.
No.
And to arrive without money or credit cards on launch day. So the details at this point are still very vague. Contestants, though, are really happy to fill in the details once again. When friends and family ask questions, they tell them everything was tightly under wraps and they weren't allowed to say. But the truth is that they didn't know. They only knew, in addition to these instructions they were given, they were also told to bring a passport, which really got people excited, thinking that this would be some kind of international treasure hunt. And some people purchased things that they thought would be useful while traveling. And like if they were possibly staying in remote locations, people bought water purifying tablet. They bought chargers that would work in any country. They brought utensils, antibiotics, quinine tablets. They wanted to be prepared for anything. So a woman named Lucy, who wanted to be a television presenter, I mentioned her earlier, she actually has a big dream come true because she's also, in addition to being a contestant, she was hired as a presenter on the show as well. What? So she'll be a presenter for her whatever segments on the show. In just a short while, all of their lives would change forever. But not in the way they thought.
Uh-oh.
We'll take a break here and come back.
Okay.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
So launch day arrives and the contestants have been split up into three groups and they meet in three different locations in London. Now, when the contestants arrive to this launch, it is pretty lackluster. There's no fanfare. There's no celebrities, like not even a D-lister. contestants are kind of like a little disappointed. And some of them in the team are the cameramen. They're recording what's happening. Rushen did hire some unpaid cameramen to be there, but they were also contestants. So it was just like, kind of like, what's going on here? So production members, who they knew to be production members, also seemed to just be walking around the area, but no one really knew anything. Lucy, as I mentioned, is on team two. She's a contestant as well as a presenter. And she's talking to fellow contestants who begin asking her questions. And she's like, I have no idea. Nick finally shows up to talk to Lucy. And he's like, can you present the idea of the show to the contestants? And she says, she was like, can you tell me first? So it is at this point that everyone learns what the challenge is. In a year, they all had to make 1 million pounds. Their first task was to find accommodations for themselves for free for a week. The contestants slowly realized that despite what their contracts had claimed, they would have to find their own food and accommodations and would essentially be making their own prize money. Many contestants were absolutely sickened and like dismayed. They had given up jobs. Many had ended leases on their flats, and some had even ended relationships to do this year-long thing.
This is crazy.
At this point, a lot of contestants demanded to have a one-on-one with Nick Rushen to get answers from him personally. And it was at this point that Nick revealed that no television channel had yet commissioned, which means like picked up the show.
No.
Contestants were in a panic. Who was this man that they had trusted completely and gave up their lives for?
He's the Music Man.
Follow me. So let's get a little background here. There's not a ton, but there's some. Nikita Nick Rushen was born Keith Anthony Gillard in Surrey in 1977. In the documentary, we talked to his childhood friend Mike, who shows us a ton of videos of the pair that they would make growing up, these kind of comedic sketch type things. And they were actually pretty good. Like, it's very British humor stuff, but I thought they were pretty well made. And kind of funny. Michael describes Keith as being highly intelligent and creative. He says that Keith, in his mid to late teens, had something happen where his personality completely changed. He started acting strangely, skipping school, and eventually left home at the age of 17. In his early 20s, he legally changes his name to Jack Lister before eventually changing it to Nikita Rushen. He has various unsuccessful businesses. He writes several unpublished novels before he decides that he wants to go back to his roots and produce his own reality TV show. At that point, he reconnects with his old friend Michael, who is now doing stand-up comedy, and asks him if he wants to get involved with the project. He describes to Michael this kind of reality show slash sitcom hybrid, and Michael is on board and even enthusiastic to be working again with his childhood friend. It was just like old times. Then it's crickets. Like, he doesn't hear from Nick for a year. Then he gets a call, Nick saying he has a director now and that he's holding auditions soon if Michael wants to come along. At this point, Michael has seen the flyers and advertisements, so he asks Nick about the prize money, assuming that he's been commissioned by a production company or a TV channel who will be providing this money. When Nick says no, that he hasn't, Michael's confused and he's like, so are you putting something together to sell this idea to a TV station? You're selling the idea, right? Is that what's happening? And Nick is like, no, I'll be producing it myself. And Michael is stunned since he knows Nick doesn't have $100,000 prize money that's being advertised in these ads and flyers. And he says, so you're lying to people then? Because that's immoral. And Nick responds in sort of a philosophical way that morals don't actually exist. It's like a human thing that we've made up.
Come on.
So despite this, Michael agrees to attend the auditions, which he is surprised to see seem pretty legit when he arrives. Things seem to be running smoothly. There are a lot of people walking around seeming professional. There are canapes.
Uh-oh.
I was like, ooh.
Canapes.
Say no more. He says the task and challenges seemed kind of fun and interesting. But then something really sticks out to him. He realizes that the psychoanalyst that was there to interview potential contestants is actually one of Nick's ex-girlfriends who hadn't even graduated college, much less became a psychoanalyst. Other professional entertainment.
So she's just sitting around interviewing these people like, so tell me the worst thing that's ever happened
she's
to you.
She's put on her glasses and has her hair in a loose bun.
Yeah.
He's like, other professional entertainment people also turned out to be various friends of Nick's. So Michael isn't the only one who's having some doubts. The director who was hired and so intrigued by Nick's concept is also starting to be like, this seems off. He had happily agreed to work for free, assuming that a commission or financing was coming in at some point. When he found out that Nick had not sold the idea or gotten any money to film a pilot, he bails too. So Ironically, he bails due to lack of money, even though the pitch that Nick gave him was about making money your bitch. His concept was money had such a grip on the world that he wanted to do a show where they showed money who's the boss and not let money rule them. In the documentary, we see a clip that the director films of Nick explaining his concept, almost like an intro to the show. Like, this is like what you would see every week. Like, here right. we are explaining the concept. And Nick is kind of walking down the street, talking into the camera, saying, money is the biggest obstacle on the way to personal freedom. If you can figure out that, you're laughing the rest of your days. 9 to 5 is not the way. In fact, there's actually no security in that. What if you had an option for a way out of that? I found 30 people to do something seriously bizarre. We're going to take money on at its own game and we're going to win. So, but in the end, the director's like, I need some money to prove that money can't win. And he kind of bails. So back at the launch, things are not going well. Nick is pacing around the Team 2 launch site at this point. He's on his phone. Contestants are so baffled that some of them even convince themselves that this is actually the first challenge.
Right.
That this is all part of the show. And cameras are just getting their reactions to see how they handle like stressful news. Team 2 decides to get over their initial disappointment and start trying to achieve the goal. One contestant, Louise Miles, who was not on Team 2, she describes the scene over at her camp by saying, there was no central meeting point, and then Nick turned up looking a bit shabby. He had dirty jeans on and didn't look as slick as he did at the audition. She said when they found out what the challenge was, she said, this was her thoughts on it. She's like, all the money we raised was to go into a bank account, which Nick had access to. At that point, I started thinking I'd made a huge mistake. There was no way we could raise 1 million pounds because if I'd had the potential to do that, I would have done it by myself. I wouldn't have needed these plonkers to help me. And that is very true. Like, they're basically, it's like they could just earn $100,000 anytime they wanted to, if that's the concept. Like,
yeah.
So what Team 2 doesn't know at this point is that Teams 1 and 3 have already disbanded and left their launches furious and disgusted.
Wait, they've left?
Yes, they're out. All those teams are out. So one group from Team 2 named Tim, he lived nearby. So Team 2 decides that they're going to go back to his flat and make a plan. In addition to being a contestant, Tim is also a cameraman. He's filming everything.
Wait, they're going to make a plan
to do the challenge. These guys all want to make it work. They're like, let's go.
So, okay, Team 1 and 3 have left the competition.
They've left. Team 2 doesn't know that. And Team 2 are going to a flat to make a plan.
They're still in.
They're still in.
What's like the first... Okay, wait, what's the first challenge again?
They need to find a place to live and get food.
This is so mean.
So... many people say they will stay on, but they need a guarantee that eventually their food and lodging will be provided for. But until then, like I said, they're filming everything and they're acting, they're participating as if the show has started. The first challenge, as I mentioned, is to get food. So they kind of have a place to stay. They're staying at Tim's. They're going to go get food. And they do that. Several women go out around the streets of London and return with a bag full of groceries that they got for free. They start showing things in the documentary because all of this footage is available. One woman takes out an avocado and she's like, we got a guacamole. Now, I need to know, do people in the UK call avocados guacamoles?
First of all, I would never eat an avocado from the UK.
It was a shocking moment for me because I was like, I agree. I was like, wait, what? You have? I was like, that must be rock hard. But I was like, it's not a guacamole. Like,
we got a guacamole. Like,
that's what she said. And they're like, yay. Like, we've completed our first challenge. They're like living. So that first night they do what everyone in the UK is doing. They watch Big Brother. They film themselves watching Big Brother on TV.
Oh, that's so cool.
They also decide that, like Big Brother, they're going to set up a video diary room. So they put a camera up in like one of the extra bedrooms for people to go in and give their little like testimonials.
So they're also producing this show.
Basically. So the people just like, I've seen some of these diary room things. They go in there and share their feelings about what life is like on the show. And they're really convincing themselves at this point that the show they're on is a cross between Big Brother and Survivor. So several nights after the launch date, Nick shocks everyone when he arrives at Tim's flat. He spends the night playing parlor games with his cast while they film them playing parlor games, which is just like board games.
Yeah.
Not one of the contestants asked Nick a single question about what's going on. And he's just hanging out with them in this parlor game room. He leaves that night completely reinvigorated by the team's determination. And he begins to think that this is the spark he needs to launch the show into something bigger. Like, this spark can catch fire. And maybe this is the show. So when he leaves, the team start to regret not questioning him more, but they also begin to wonder how the other teams are doing, and they want to reach out to them.
Oh my God.
So they do reach out to someone, and what they find out is shocking. Apparently one of the other teams, when they left the launch site, went to a friend's near, like one of the contestants' friends nearby flat. While they're sitting there talking about what's going on, and they're not talking about what they're going to do for the show. At this point, they're like, what's happened? They're just kind of commiserating about what the fuck has happened. She overhears them discussing things, obviously. And when she hears the name Nick Rushton, she's like, wait a minute, hold up.
So this is the friend of a contestant.
Yeah, she's just a friend, and she's just kind of eavesdropping and whatever.
She knows this name.
She's like, that bloke works with me at Waterstone's bookstore. Like, he works with her at the bookstore. No. He is not a television producer. He's just a clerk at a bookstore. He's like a, you know, and they're like, he doesn't even work there full time. He works there like part time. So they're like, okay, they demand a meeting at that point, and he films this meeting. So the contestants are like, so do you have a deal with a TV channel?
Nick Rushton did?
Yeah, he meets them.
And he films?
He films this confrontation with these people. So he's like, yeah, I don't have anyone. There's not a commission. I don't have anyone interested in buying the idea. And he tells them at this point, though, he is hoping with all the footage he has now to put together something from this footage to give to his salespeople, and that they can make a promo video to take to the networks for sale. So they're like, okay, this whole thing is just an elaborate farce. Like, this is not happening. So other things they find out, he hasn't even paid for the use of that island. As I mentioned, most of the crew were just college students or friends that he got in these jobs to look like they were doing something. On a lot of the emails and professional, you know, production company emails, they had names like Doug Travers and Amy Dixon, who were like the co-coordinator, the team leader. None of those people existed. And the production company itself is completely fictitious. Like, it is not a real entity at all. So according to Mike, who is the friend, the childhood friend, he's like, I said to him, you're pretending to be a TV producer. And he said, I'm producing a show for TV, so I am a TV producer. At that point, I didn't know how manipulative he was. He had tried to set up businesses before unsuccessfully, and the failure of that perhaps prompted him to think he was something that he's not. He did say at one point that he was 25 and not sure where he wanted to be in his life. So they all immediately leave this meeting, and Team 2 at this point is hearing all this, realize that they've also been duped and that they've been playing, like, unlike Team 1 and 3, they've been doing this for a week now.
Oh, it's been a week?
Yes. They've been doing this for a week now for no fucking reason. So they began discussing their options. By the way, they're literally all in the floor of a living room, like sleeping on the floor for a week in this guy's flat. Like,
this is crazy.
So they began discussing their options, like, should we go to the authorities? Should we contact the media? While they're discussing this, Nick shows up with two beers. I'm
sorry. Just two?
Just two beers. And they confront him, and he says to them that he's also lost everything to do the show, and he pitches his new idea saying, like, maybe this is the show. Needless to say, everyone is pissed. And he sleeps over that night on the floor next to them in the living room. one contestant named John freaks out in the middle of the night, and he's like, I'm going to kill him. And all the contestants calm him down. And Nick's just snoring on the floor. One woman talked about how his head was on her shoulder, and he stole one's pillow. Like, he's just on the floor. When they wake up in the morning, Nick is gone. And then they really began their plan to take him down. Tim has a connection to a show called London Tonight, and he gets them to agree to come to his flat and tell their story. Now, the night before cameras are supposed to come, Nick shows up again.
No.
Yeah.
This guy has so much confidence.
He has nowhere to go. He's like basically homeless. The contestants don't tell him about the camera crew is coming the next morning, and they basically hold him hostage, not letting him leave. He's in the diary room. So there's footage of him like pacing and saying, like, just like really struggling with what's happening to him. They like go at him. They're like, you ruined our dreams. And he counters, you know, my dream is also ruined. And they're like, we don't give a fuck. Like, it's like this kind of footage. And it's kind of comical, but also tragic at the same time. So this is all on tape. So you really should check out the documentary to see some of this footage, because it is crazy. I mean, he's truly defeated. And at this time, he is scared because these people are holding him hostage and they hate his guts.
Yeah.
So the cameras do come, and they are able to interview Nick. He's basically, you know, his head is down the whole time, but he does the interview. He's really broken at this point, and it's kind of sad to see. He says that he wasn't trying to scam anybody, but by the time he realized everyone had given up all of these things to be on his show, he was in over his head, and he felt like he had to keep pushing forward, even though all these, like, the director had dropped out. He knew there was no money.
What did he think was going to happen?
I mean, that's what I was talking about with, like, the Willy Wonka experience. Like, I do feel like there's these people who have all these big plans and they cannot execute it.
They can't execute it. And even when they realize they can't execute it, they still somehow move forward with it, which is like the crazy part.
Yeah, that's where I'm like, I don't get that. Like, you got to suck it up and admit you fucked up before it gets bigger.
The event's canceled. The reality show's canceled.
So even when the London Tonight piece comes out, Nick still has delusions that they can use that media attention to get the show off the ground for real this time. But no one's interested at this point. And he's pretty much abandoned by everyone and kind of disappears. In the documentary, they have like this tracer, a woman who's like an expert at finding people, and she actually finds Nick.
No one's been
able to find him for like 20 years, and he's interviewed. So we find out a little bit about what happened to him. He says for 15 years, he was in a deep depression. He really could not handle the weight of what he did to these people. Like, he did seem to recognize how awful what he did was. He became an alcoholic because he obviously used alcohol to drink away the pain. And he admitted that he never was trying to scam anyone. And like, he truly did fuck up. He didn't know how to stop the train from rolling. Like, he just did not know how to do it. He's very vague about what happened in his late teens, but does confirm that something did happen that sent him down a path of depression, feeling like he was having an identity crisis. And that's why he does change his name a lot early on in his life. He was trying to figure out who he was and what he wanted to do in the world. And obviously, it seems like his big thing was kind of creating worlds, because he was a writer, and sort of having this fantasy life. So I think it all just kind of exploded in a really horrible way. Now he goes by Nick Quentin Wolf, and he has written a book. He is married and has two kids and seems to be like on a good path now. They do talk to a lot of the cast members, and they also seem to have gone on with their lives. Some did go into acting. Most people seem fine. Some people are even grateful for the experience because it set them on the path that they're on now, where they're happy. One sad person, the guy who was like, I'm going to kill him, John, he did say that his one sort of thing that he hates that happened to him after that experience was it made him more risk averse. Mm. Like, he didn't feel like he could take chances anymore. Like, this was his one thing he did, and it obviously was horrible. So the interesting thing, obviously, the media at the time most, for the most part, placed blame on Nick, describing him as a con man. Some took a sympathetic tone. I mentioned the writer Rupert Smith, who described him as kind of a tragic figure. But a lot of people actually victim blamed the contestants.
Whoa.
Calling them gullible wannabes who got their dream of being on TV, just not in the right. So this is like, now it's like to the point where people are like, fuck all these people who want to be on reality TV. They're narcissists. Right. They're like, whatever. What do they expect? Like, this is what they get for having shallow desires. Rupert Smith, he has like a more gentle tone with them. He's like, these aren't stupid people. Obviously, when you see them doing this fake show, they look like any other Big Brother buffoon. But when you see these interviews with them, you know, in the documentary, they come across as likable and wounded individuals, like they were hurt by this.
Well, they were conned, and he went out of his way to make it, to present something that was not real.
And it's an interesting psychological thing that we've talked about with cults and with like following charismatic leaders. You start to convince yourself that you haven't been stupid.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You don't want to admit that you fell for something.
Right.
So you kind of go further than you maybe would normally because you want it to be true.
Yeah.
So then you don't look like you made a mistake. And Rupert Smith also said that the whole thing was a timely reminder that the kind of fame that's based only on exposure rather than actual talent is a house built on sand, which I thought was like an interesting way to look at it. Like,
yeah,
because it is a weird thing that's new, where it's like all these people wanting to be famous just to be famous is definitely a thing, I think, still.
Of course it's still a thing. And it's given rise to like other sort of iterations of that sort of original, like just a bunch of random people in a house. It's like anyone can be an influencer now on Instagram or TikTok or whatever.
And it's an appealing path to go down. Like you can see why people are like, I could do that and make a ton of money.
Right.
Like, why not?
Yeah. That's so wild. This guy, I mean, it just, to me, I can't wrap my head around like putting in all of that effort for this kind of thing. Like him putting in all this effort, like hiring, I mean, even though he like didn't pay anybody, but like coordinating all of this, and it's like not even a real thing.
But that's how you know, I think, that he really was trying to do something.
He just was like so delusional.
You know, he had no connections or skill at all. Like it was, it's like, this is not making videos when you're 12.
He's also a reality show contestant.
No, I mean, I do think in a way, the contestants on the documentary, they said something funny where I was like, wait, what? They're like, what if this is his documentary? We don't even know we're all on his documentary.
What if it was a 20-year long con?
I know. And I, for a second, I was like, wait, did he produce this? Because I was like, I feel conned now.
And it what was just if them it's joking. A 20-year long con, Desi?
No, it was crazy. But he is like, you can kind of see when you saw him interviewed, even though he's older now, he's still kind of like good looking. I mean, he's, you know, older and like looks different, but like you kind of get it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like I could see, be like, okay, this guy seems cool.
He was just born in the wrong decade. He needed to be born like 2 decades later so he could have been an Instagram influencer.
Right. I agree.
Like had a podcast.
I thought it was a very wild story that I had so never crazy. Heard.
Did he ever come up with a title for the show?
No.
Or just Project
MK Ultra? I did want to say that some people did try to press charges.
Oh.
But there was technically no crime because he didn't steal their money. Like that never actually happened. And then some people tried to start a civil case, but they didn't have the funds to really pursue it. And I don't think he had money, so it was kind of a lost cause.
Right.
So there were people attempting to get him to face more consequences, but I think he suffered though. So
I mean, he definitely suffered publicly. Like he was humiliated.
Oh yeah. He talks in the documentary about like just walking down the street or being in he was in a pub when that London Tonight aired that segment.
Oh my God.
And everyone was like looking at him. He's like, I had that experience where all of a sudden everyone's like, is that you?
Right.
Like just sitting there. And it was like, he was pretty recognizable, like in that moment, that immediate aftermath. Another funny thing, because I was looking up, I was trying to find like a UK story, because we've always talked about doing some UK celebrities that aren't really big over here, but the trashy ones, like the Katy Price.
Yeah.
So I was trying to find something, and I looked up like UK scandals from the 2000s, and I found a really funny Reddit thread. That's not where I found this story, because I switched my search at some point. But I mentioned it in our Discord group on the Patreon, where it was like this woman who threw a cat in a bin to play a prank on her neighbor. The cat's okay.
Okay.
But she became the most hated woman in the UK. And people in our UK group in the Discord, the subgroup, were like, oh yeah, everyone hated her. She was like the villain of the country for like many years.
Yeah.
For doing this. And she's kind of like an unlikable woman too, because when she got busted, she was like, it's just a joke, like whatever. But there was other funny scandals too that I just came across that just always make me laugh, because they're so like different than what they would be here. They're very like UK. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
It's just very funny to kind of read other people's scandal.
I love reading about what drama is happening in the UK.
Oh my God. It's like another world.
I used to read my mom's Tatlers.
Oh, right.
She had a subscription to Tatler. So when I was like in my teens, I knew all the UK celebrities.
Right. No, we've talked about this before a bit, because I was obsessed with Katy Price and her husband, who I can't remember his name right now, but he had a lot of plastic surgery as well. And they were just like on every page. There's like that girl, not Page Six, but there's like a Page Girl where it's like a sexy model type. And some of them get more presenter jobs from that, right. I think. So I was like, I was always reading about those, because they were kind of in the US gossip sites sometimes. Some of them would cross over. Some of them would cross over.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would definitely would love to look more into those UK scandals from the early 2000s. So if you know any, send us some links in our Discord.
Yeah, we'll cover them.
Yeah, I'm interested, because it's really fun, I think.
Well, thank you, Desi. That was a story I'd never heard before. And if you want to hear more about reality television, we're currently covering Rock of Love and American Idol Season 5 on Patreon, patreon.com/HollywoodCrimeScene. We're covering, or we're doing other stuff there too. We just posted our recap of Irish Wish.
Oh, yeah. And we have recorded a recap or in-depth review of Quiet on the Set.
That'll be posted soon.
Yeah. So we have a lot of stuff up right now.
Yeah.
And old stuff too that you can access.
Yeah, we got our whole back catalog.
Yeah.
So we'll see you later this week for the mini episode. Bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.